Welcome, Brandy Jenkins. I'm so happy you're here today. Thank you for accepting the invitation.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So you have, as you'd put it, had a life that has been one wild ride after another.
Definitely.
Take us back to your childhood. You started out, you were in the foster care system. Share with us what that was like and what happened then.
Well, first, I was in the foster care system, but so were my parents. My parents were in the system when they met, and they had me, they ran away and they had me. So they were already coming from a bad situation, and they weren't ready to be parents. And so I ended up being raised by my great grandmother. And I was raised with her until I was about 11, and she became too old. She was in her 80s at that point to take care of me. And she was scared to tell me. So she had some cousins of mine come over one day, and they offered to take me to their house for the weekend, which I had never been over there. And I was like, okay, cool. They had a pool, and I was really excited. And when I got there, they told me that I was going to be living with them now. So I was taken from my home that I knew and placed with them. They were also very religious people. So they were Mormon, very strict rules they had in the house. And so I lived pretty sheltered from that time with them there. Wasn't allowed to talk to boys on the phone. Definitely wasn't allowed to date. So I didn't have street smarts, period. None of them. I was on honor roll. I was a leader in my church. I played softball. I was in a play. I did some acting. I did all sorts of extracurricular activities, but I had zero knowledge of the real world. So one day, a similar situation happened where I was at school and a social worker called me into the office. And I had been living with this family for 3 years at that point. And the social worker just told me, they said, it's not working out. You're coming with me now. And they actually told me that the mom had said that the dad was watching me change clothes, like through a window in the bedroom. And so she was like, it's not a safe place for you anymore. You need, you know, that's why you're going to go with us. And I had never gotten a bad vibe from him. So I didn't really believe it, but I was still like, okay, well, if it's not safe, it's not safe. So I have to go.
Right.
So I left and they took me to a new city. And so it was all new people again. And then this happened 3 or 4 times, where I stayed for a few months. Somebody somewhere decided it didn't work out. They moved me to a new place. And each time it was a new city. So it was a new school, all new friends. Nobody called or connected from the last place. And I think eventually I just started to get lost.
Yeah.
And I didn't have any contact from any family members at all during that time. My parents were on drugs and gone for years at a time. So I was at a group home actually in Concord, which is where I live now. And they had decided after I cut school a couple times, so I got into some trouble. And they said that I was being bad. And so they were going to send me to a bad place so I could learn a lesson.
Oh.
Yeah. So,
and how old were you at this point, Brandy?
14.
Okay.
So I was 14 turning 15. And they sent me to Richmond, California, which, is known for like having a lot of crime and, just not a, like where I had been from, it was just a more of a crime kind of area. So I got there that night, and there was another girl who got there that same night. She was from Hawaii at the time, but they had flown her back here. So we were the only people in the group home that night that weren't Muslim. It was a Muslim group home. So that was a new religion that we weren't aware of. And just, we felt out of place there.
Yeah.
And we didn't know anything about it. So we were only there for 24 hours. The next day, a girl came. She was 17 years old, and she told us that she used to live there at the same group home. And she said that she could provide us with a better life, that she had an apartment and that if we came with her, we could live in that apartment, and that we'd only have to pay $100 a month for rent. And in my head, I was like, I can come up with that somehow. But I didn't know how. But she had promised us, she said, this will be a home where you could live and you'll never get kicked out. You won't have to deal with that ever again. And so that was appealing. Right. And she said, if we wanted it, we had to leave with her right then.
Oh, wow.
So me and the other girl, and she was 13, we went in the bathroom, and I remember both of us were washing our faces, and we decided, you know, are we going to go or not go? And we just said, okay, we're going.
Yeah.
So we left with just what we had on. And we knew the second we left that all of our stuff would be ransacked and we wouldn't have anything to come back to if we had left it there, you know?
I ask, why did you leave without your stuff? So they wouldn't know you were leaving?
Because yeah, it was such a, like a right then type of thing. Mm. It was like, you have the chance right now to run out of the door or not, you know? So we left and we ended up, we walked actually maybe a block to the new place.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it was right around the corner. And so I think that they targeted that group home actually quite a bit for recruiting. So when we got there, there was an older woman there. She was like probably about 40. And she cooked us some food and we were just hanging out. And then the girl told us she was going to introduce us to someone. And an older Black man came in, and at the time he told us he was 30, but now that I'm older, he was probably in his 40s then, like maybe 45 or something. Mm-hmm. And he was a big guy. He was like 6'3", 250 pounds or something, but just a big and intimidating looking. So he came in and he had a gun and told us that we were going to be working for him now.
What, this is all the very first night, like right away?
Yeah, the very first night. So he did tell us that he would give us 2 weeks to get used to the idea before we actually had to do something. And so for 2 weeks, you know, he let us eat fast food when we wanted and took us shopping and bought us a couple new outfits. And, you know, we were happy with that. So I was scared. I had only had sex 3 times before this and with a guy my age. So I didn't know at all anything. And he ended up telling everyone else to leave that night, and he took me with him and had me doing things with him pretty much all night that night. That was torture. That night really sucked.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't ready for that.
Yeah.
And that night he told me I was his favorite too, which I didn't know that was going to come with some consequences. Mm. And he said, I can tell you're not like the other girls. And I think what he meant by that really was because I was not street smart at all. So the other girls kind of had come from a different type of background than I had. And that showed. So then over time, he decided for us that we would have to escort versus walking on the track, which was what the other girls did. He said because we were white, and we would get kidnapped if we were to be on the street. And he said that he had that happen to girls before. Oh, wow. And that they got into a car and he never saw them again. So he got us an apartment in a nice neighborhood because he said that was like the best way that we wouldn't stick out. And so we got an apartment in El Cerrito, California, which is also in the Bay Area. It's a little bit... 10 minutes past Richmond into a little bit of a nicer place. Not much nicer though. So that time there was 4 of us living in that apartment. The older woman that had started with us, me and the 13-year-old and a 16-year-old girl. And the 16-year-old lived at 2. There was another apartment set aside with other girls in it. And those girls were the ones that worked the track normally. So there became like kind of an animosity too, between the two of us, because of the different like working scenarios of how it worked. But anyway, so we started escorting there. And so lots of different guys would come over all different times of the day or night. And we started making some friends in the neighborhood with some boys that lived there. And, you know, they would tell us, they were like, we knew what you were doing, you know, immediately. And our parents knew, everybody knew, but nobody said anything. And everyone also knew that we were not adults, that it was like multiple teenagers living there. And over time, we ended up with like eight teenage girls living there at that house. So
how old were those boys that said they knew you guys weren't adults?
They were our age, like okay. 15, 14, 16, 17, but generally they're about the same age as us.
So like the parents and everybody all knew it was happening, but it's just nobody does anything.
Yeah. And they, I guess, wanted to mind their own business. I don't exactly know. I never saw the parents that I remember. I just remember hearing that the kind of like they were telling the kids not to hang out with us.
Okay.
Well, they were anyway. So that went on for a while, and we ended up like developing some good friends. And I had a routine where there was somebody always that had to be at the house that answered the phone, and the rest of us would hang out at a park that was nearby. And whenever we got paged, when we had to go back upstairs and do what we had to do, and then we'd come back down to the park. So that became our routine. And that's kind of also what angered the other girls, because they didn't have that ability, you know, to have that freedom. So what ended up happening, though, is that some of the girls started becoming boyfriend and girlfriend with the neighborhood boys.
Oh, with the local boys, yeah, in the neighborhood.
So one of the girls had done that in particular, and she had sex with one of the boys, and the other girls at the other house found out about it. And that was against the rules because he didn't pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
So they told on her. And one day, I just remember we came home from somewhere, and we come in the house, and the guy had came, and he just used to sporadically come to the house to collect his money, cook crack. He also cooked and sold crack, and then sleep with us when he wanted to. So he had showed up this day, and he closed all the windows in the house. And we knew when he closed the windows, that meant something was about to happen. No good. So we all kind of got scared. And then he told the girl that he wanted to talk to her, and they went in the room together. And the rest of us went into the next bedroom, and we were all just kind of quietly talking about what we thought was going on or what had happened. And that was when one of the girls had told that she told on her for what she had done. And she was like, well, she's going to get her punishment now. Which there were different times and different reasons and different things where a girl would get a punishment. So we had all had that happen to us before. So it wasn't like we were, you know, like we weren't as worried, like, cause we had all did it. We had all gotten, it was like getting a spanking or something when you're little, you've had one before, so you know, or whatever, but this wasn't like that. So all of a sudden we started like really hearing her scream and we were like freaking out, and we're like, what's going on? And then she's like really screaming bloody murder. And, we were scared. Nobody knew what to do. He always had his gun on him. And he used to tell us that he would kill us all the time. Like that he used to say, like, if we ever told on him or, got him in trouble where he went to jail, that he would murder us for sure, definitely. He said he would come back, no matter if we were 6 or 60, he would find us and he would kill us. And he would say, like, you won't even know it was coming. So everyone was kind of scared, but we were hearing her scream. And then I finally was just like, I can't take this anymore. Like, this isn't right, and somebody has to do something. So I went in the room. And when I went in there, it was covered in blood. There was blood everywhere. And he had her kneeling between his legs, and he had his gun to her head, and he was making her lick the blood off of him from her body. So I was just like, you have to stop. Like, you can't do this right now. So he pointed the gun to me and he told me, you know, to get out. And I said, you know, all right, you know, I'll get out. But I was like, you can't do this. You have to stop right now. So I left the room and he did stop. And everybody left the house except for me and her. So I went and I sat with her while she took a bath, and the whole bath was red. And then she was telling me, you know, I have to go. And I was like, yeah, you know, you do. You know, we have to figure out a way. So we found someone that she knew that said that they would come get her. So I walked with her down to the park and waited for her to get her ride. I didn't have anywhere to go myself, so I had to stay. So we let her leave, and nobody asked where she went or anything when we got back. I think that they all knew what had just took place had just went too far. So maybe 2 or 3 weeks later, we all got wind that they didn't go to the police and that there was going to be an investigation. So we, one night he came
to the police.
When they picked her up, they took her to get the rape kit done. And so they had called the police, you know, from the hospital immediately. Okay. One day, and like 2 weeks had passed, we knew there was an investigation, but we didn't know what exactly was going on. He came and one of the other girls and told me and the 13-year-old girl that were there together that we had to pack our stuff and leave because there was going to be, you know, it was going to get worse. And so we said, okay, so we packed all our stuff and we didn't have anywhere to go, but we walked to one of the neighborhood boys' house just to try to figure it out, you know, for a couple hours. We could probably stay there. And they ended up driving by us. And then, so they took all of our stuff and then they dumped it at the Berkeley Marina into the water. And later on, I found out that some of my stuff was found and that they notified my family that I was missing. They hadn't found me, but they found all my belongings in the water there. But no one came looking for me still. So after that, we were dealing with a couple of things. We were homeless. It was me and the 13-year-old. I was 15 at that time. She was 13. And we had left with just what we had on again. So we were dealing with that. And he started sending us money, Western Union. He went and turned himself into jail too. The house was raided. There was helicopters. It was huge, but nobody was there when it happened because we had left that night before. Somehow he had gotten a tip that it was going to happen.
Wow.
So we spent.
You wonder, doesn't it?
Yeah.
He got tipped off somehow. Like, who was he paying off or something?
Yeah. Well, when I get to the part about the police, they were just as corrupt as the bad guy. So during the time that I was there being trafficked, I was arrested with the other girl, the 13-year-old, in Oakland. And they watched us get out of the car with the pimp. So they knew we had one. And then we got arrested and they were asking us our age. And he had told us to lie and say we were adults. That way, if we got arrested, we could get bailed out. And he would tell us, like, if we said we were kids, if we got arrested, they would keep us there and not let us out. And so we were scared of staying in jail and even going back to the foster care system, because that wasn't fun either. So we were lying to the police, trying to come up with these ages for them. And I couldn't do the math. I was under pressure. So I was like, he'd be like, what year are you born? And I'd say a year. And then he goes, okay, now how old does that make you? And I'd get it completely wrong. And we did that like 10 times. So I know he knew I was lying, you know, and I knew I was lying, but they took me and the 13-year-old that night to the adult jail. And we stayed the night there. And then we're bailed out by our pimp the next day and returned back to him. And nobody batted an eye at that time at all. So I'm sure that that happened to other girls too, not just us. So, so then back to where we're running from the police. And the reason is we didn't want to testify because he had promised to kill us if we did.
Yes.
And so we were like, you know, I don't want to be involved in this in any type of way. So we were running from him. We were running from his people that we didn't want to find us either. We were running from the police because we didn't want them to find us or didn't think that would be safe. We were running from the foster care system because that wasn't safe and we didn't want to be there either. So we spent some time just on the streets. And during that time, multiple other people tried to take advantage of us. So one lady offered us a place to stay and we went to her house and we stayed there for a couple of days. And like on the third day, she had some friends come over, male friends, and they were adults, all of them, and asked and told us that they were going to take us to buy some weed. And we were like, all right. So we left with them. And when they took us to a hotel and then told us that the lady had sold us to them for the night.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So that was another torturous night out of all the nights, because usually when we did something, it was like quick, you know, it was an hour or something like that. This time was all night with these two guys, and they were making sure they used that whole night wisely, how they wanted to. And so the next day we said that we can't do this anymore. This doesn't work. I'm not going back to that lady's house. And so I made a plan, and we decided to enter back into the foster care system, but not as who we were. So we made up fake names that day and a fake story. And I said, we'll just tell them that our dad abandoned us and that, you know, we were living alone for a while and, you know, we couldn't do that anymore. So we went and we found a BART police officer and we told him our story. And he called the social services, which they knew we had holes in our story too. Cause they're like, what school did you go to? And I was like, we never went to school. We've just been living in our dad's basement for the last 20 years. I don't know. But so they took us into a group home and we lived there for about a month and a half under these fake names with our story. And one day I was walking to 7-Eleven near there and a police officer stopped me and he had a wanted poster with my picture on it. But the problem was, and they had got it that night, they raided the house. They put the other girl's name under mine and my name under hers. Oh. So I was like, that's not me. Got the wrong girl. And they couldn't prove it was me. So they had to let me go. But they figured out then where I lived.
Got it. And they were coming to get you to testify. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yep.
So they tapped the phone there at the house. They did want us to testify. So the next day or two later, I went to visit the boys back at the old house. So me and the other girl were there and they had tapped the phone. So they knew we were there that night. So they raided their house. So that night, there was maybe 8 police cars that had showed up and they took us to a jail in El Cerrito. And it was just me and the 13-year-old girl and 2 cops. And they kept us there all night and separated us and asking us all sorts of questions. And, you know, the guy had told us a whole script. Like, if they arrest you, no matter what, say you don't even know who I am. You know, blah, blah, blah. So I stuck to that. I was like, I've never seen that person before. You know, I'm not telling you anything. The guy did trick me into saying one thing because he was like promising me the world at that point. The cop tried to offer us cigarettes, concert tickets, food, whatever they could think of that would get us to do what they wanted to do. They were trying to offer it. So he did tell me, he could straighten out anything if I had any legal problems that I wanted to mention, because he was like, it is going to be found out.
Wow.
regardless, so I told him about the time I was arrested as an when I was a minor, but as an adult. So instead of helping me like he promised, he charged me with that for lying to a police officer about my age, and false ID to a cop. And
these
then
guys are as manipulative as the pimp.
Yeah, it was. Seems. It was, and it gets worse. So they took us both to jail, and I didn't know them because they had separated us. But the other girl had said that she did know who the person was. So they ended up with it, and they put fake charges on both of us so they could hold us for a certain amount of time. And then they had to let me go after a certain time that those charges couldn't, like, they kept me as long as they could. But for some reason for her, because she had talked, they wanted to keep her in there until the testify. So they were able to like stretch her out, you know, keeping her in there for a long time. But he kept waiving time on the trial. So they did end up having to let her go. So after this, we both end up back in those same group homes that we now were in, that we had used the fake name under. And those were actually the nicest group homes that I had been in. And the lady at first was like mad at me, but I was like, no, you don't understand. Like all the trouble, this happened before we met. Like everything, you know, since I've been here has been good, you know? And so she kept me and was down to keep me there, which was cool because they got into a fight, the counties did, over who would be in charge of me. And so for 6 months or maybe 8 months, no one would pay for me to live there at the group home. So she just let me live there out of the kindness of her heart.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah,
because and they were in a battle over who would take responsibility, whether it was, now they wanted Oakland to take responsibility since they had me last in their custody. But I had never lived in Oakland. So that's what, like, the argument. But anyway, but things did end up going bad again at the group homes. And I did decide again that I would rather take my chances on the streets than live there. So I did. And I was still trying to go to school, though. And so a couple of times I enrolled in, like, adult school. And those officers would still look for me and try to snag me wherever they could, whenever they wanted to. So they would find me at school and then I'd have to go with them because they're the cops. So one of the officers in particular would then pick me up. He picked me up maybe 5 times from 5 different places. So I felt like there was nowhere I could hide from him. But when he picked me up, he would get me in his car and ask me sexual questions.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So I remember the main one that sticks out is that he like kept asking me if I like anal sex. And so I knew the police can't be trusted. No one can be trusted at this point but yourself.
Yes.
So I ended up finding a place to live from 16 and up, where I basically stayed in the house from 16 to 18 because I didn't want to be found by the police or by anyone. And during that time, so the other thing is when they wanted us to testify, they swore, they were like, if you do this, he is getting life in prison. He will never get out. You'll never have to worry about him getting out. I mean, luckily, thank goodness, I stayed away. I never got to a position where I was forced into testifying because he took a plea deal, but he was only given 10 years. Like, so even if we would have testified and all that, you know, I'd have had to live in fear for the rest of my life.
The rest of your life, exactly. It's just, they didn't do anything. And it's just, it's so disheartening to hear how the police were about the whole thing.
Yeah. And
you think, there's clear cut good guys and bad guys in this story. And it's just not the case. Not even a little bit.
Yeah.
So you were inside, captive from 16 to 18. And then what happened? Because I look at you today and you've got this beautiful life and you're contributing and helping people. And how did you get from there here?
More roller coaster. I was in an abusive relationship during that time and I ended up with 4 children. So from 16 to 18, I had two, and then two more after that. I left my kid's father when I was 21, and my son was one, my youngest, and I raised all my kids after that as a single parent.
Wow, you're amazing.
I put myself through college, which is another thing about no clear good guys and bad guys, because it took me 20 years to get my bachelor's degree. There were a lot of times I had to stop and take care of my kids or my household, or like finances, just I couldn't do that at that moment. So there were a lot of stops and starts, but the thing that kept me going was knowing that once I had this degree, I was going to get a decent job.
Yeah.
And I'd be able to take care of my family. So I pushed and I pushed and I pushed all the way to the bitter end, and I graduated and went back to the same job I had before. Mm. The good job never came, and now I'm in debt.
Yeah.
So that was another unclear good guy or bad guy right there. But from what I studied sociology while I was at school. And I was also studying, I always was interested from my time in the foster care system. I was taking notes on stuff that I thought was good and bad, and what I would do differently if I had the opportunity. And I think I was 15 when I decided someday that I would open my own kind of group home with my own philosophy. So again, through life, you know, I'm waiting for the opportunity for that to happen, because I had so many other things going on. You can't do it all at once. There's a time for everything. So this year, well, in 2017, I guess I really came up with a plan for a business that I wanted to create. And I sat back and I looked at it, like looking at the world, and you look at it up close, and then you back up a little bit, and then back up a little more, and back up a little more, and back up a little more until you're in space, and you can see the bigger picture, you know, kind of. And I was watching a movie or something one day, and it told me, asked me what my ultimate goal would be in life, and to think big, it said. So I was like, okay, big as I can get, big as I can get. Well, I want to do something that no one else has ever done. And I was like, what can I do? And I was like, world peace, boom, got it. So then I was like, okay, now I need to think of a plan of how to put that into action. So that is kind of how I came up with the idea for Coco's Angels. So at that time, Coco wasn't even alive. He wasn't in existence, but I had made up a kind of a business. About 6 or 7 months later, my daughter came home and told me she was pregnant. And that was a shock. And she had never even said she liked kids before that. It was not on my radar at all whatsoever. She had left for college. And so I thought that's what was happening. And she was gone for maybe 2 months when she came back. So that kind of threw our lives a little bit for a loop because we weren't ready, and she was not with the child's father. We were kind of, which now that their family's heavily involved, but when she first got pregnant, we didn't know if it was going to be just us, you know, taking care of the baby. And I had a friend of mine that was actually like a really good friend of mine. And when he was born, he was 5 days old, and she just texted me that night and said some really mean stuff. And she said that my grandson would never be loved as her child because he was born out of wedlock. And basically tried to say that he should have never even been born.
And this is a good friend.
Yeah, this is somebody that I had been friends with for maybe like 15 years.
Wow.
And she told me that I'd never amount to nothing. She just went in on me for some reason this night. And the next day she told me she apologized, but I was like, you can't come back from that. Like,
no,
the things that you just said about my grandson, like, that just is impossible to me, but to be your friend again anyway. But I thought about it that night, and I was like, no child deserves to be any less loved than any other child.
Yes.
And so I was like, that is the way that we can make my grandson love too, by giving it to everybody, to giving the same love to others. is the best way to get love in return. And so I was like, I'll be like, I am not going to let you tell me how loved my grandson can be, you know? So I later on named Coco's Angels after him. His name's Colton and his nickname is Coco.
Brandy, it's so beautiful that rather than striking out at this so-called friend, you turned it into good for every other kid.
That is my goal.
No child will be less loved than any other. Man, that's right there is a sign of such an extraordinary human being. What a huge heart you have.
Well, I've been so thrilled and excited at how well this has taken on. Because the day I started Coco's Angels, I had $2 in my bank account. Okay. I lost my job like everyone, most people did with the COVID thing happened. So I started it also. I had used my iPhone, which had a broken screen. So I had $2 and a broken iPhone. And I was like, I'm just going to go for it. Like, I'm not going to let anybody hold me back. And also, this is my vision and my plan. So I'm not going to let anyone tell me to try to change it to what they think I can do. Like, and then I had a lot of people do that. Be like, tell me it can't be done. What I'm trying to do can't be done because it hasn't been done before in the way that I'm trying to do it. But to me, that is like bullshit.
Thanks. Watch me.
Exactly. So that's exactly what I took on. So all the only way though that Coco's Angels can work, the whole premise on it is that everybody takes a part and does what they can. So I do what I can by like being the voice and advertising and also telling my story, which I had never told before either. The trafficking thing for me was always something that I was very ashamed of. And also I thought it was my fault. I thought that I was stupid and that I fell for a trick, but it was my fault because I was smarter than that. And when I started doing Coco's Angels, I started paying attention more to statistics for foster children. And I found out that in California, 50% of trafficked kids come from the foster system. So I was like, this happens all the time. You know, yes. It's not what I thought what happened to me was isolated. And then I realized that it's like super common. So like even more made me feel like something had to be done. And then the Save Our Children, you know, movement came. And that's what really gave me the courage to speak out, because before that I hadn't wanted to. So that gave me the courage really to speak out about it, because I think that it opened people's minds a little bit to the possibility of, because I did think it was my fault. And I do think that other people also thought it was my fault. If I had told them, anyone I did tell, and that was very few people, I watched the look on their face and people that maybe there was, okay, a guy I dated, we were dating for 4 years before I told him. And I watched his face just, I knew all the love just went right out of his face when I told him that. Like, he didn't think I was the same person anymore. So that's what had kept me quiet for a lot of years is the judgment. Yeah. But now with this movement, I think people started becoming more open-minded and realizing that it's not the victim that needs to be blamed. So that's what gave me the courage to talk about that. Prior to that movement, I wasn't sharing the trafficking story. I was only talking about foster care and I skipped over that part. But I do think it is important, you know, to talk about, and obviously now knowing what I know, trafficking and foster care are married. They go hand in hand.
Sure are, aren't they?
Yeah.
And nobody can raise awareness about that better than you. So earlier you told me about some of the beautiful work that you're doing with Coco's Angels. It's so inspiring. Would you share that with us?
Yes, definitely. Okay, so Coco's Angels started with the premise of helping foster children. I realized with that came orphans as well, you know, into that subject. And then we added at-risk children because some are homeless or bordering entering the foster system, or maybe were in the foster system but went home but still need help. So I put at-risk in there, and then I also want to cover trafficking victims. But basically any child who needs help, we're going to extend a hand to. So when I started with Coco's Angels, we started with the hopes of giving care packages to 6 children, foster children here in my area. And then immediately that went to 12, and then 24, and then 48. And then, and our group just kept growing and growing. We went from 10 people to almost 1,000 now. And I was just watching the kindness just spill in. So many people wanted to help. And I would get people like, with our wish list, our Amazon wish list, people write me like, I just bought the whole list. And then we'd be like, okay, we're going to add 10 more kids. Wow. on our 7th day of creating Coco's Angels, we had 143 members, which stands for love, you know, 143. And that was on the 7th day, which to me also is like the Bible, you know, 7 days of creation. And we created love on the 7th day.
Yes.
And on that day as well, we got a huge shipment from Australia. So it was on that 7th day that we reached overseas and we started getting help from overseas.
It's so beautiful. It's, you've used this hardship that you went through to make a difference for people everywhere. And I hear how you're continuing to look for every time something, you go through something challenging. You are not just a dreamer, you are a doer. Andy, thank you for sharing your beautiful story and your mission with us today. I can't wait to share it with people.
I'm excited, and I hope to get as many people on board as possible. Like I said, it's for all ages. It's for all genders. I have no judgment whatsoever. If you have a past, fine. You know, I guess I would say the only people that I'm not interested in including is people that hurt women and children, you know, but everybody else, you know, I forgive, and I don't care, you know, what bumps you had along the way. Today, we can start fresh.
Amen to that. On that note, I look forward to sharing your message as far and wide as possible, Brandy. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
If you or someone you know has been taken for sex trafficking, or you suspect that's happening, call 888-373-7888 or text the word HELP to 233-733. With your help, we can stop human trafficking now. To keep up with all of our latest work, please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Trafficked Series. Please be sure to rate, review, share, and subscribe to our podcast. I am your host, Cheryl Hunter, and we are here to end human trafficking. So remember, if you see something, say something. This is a Conveyor Media production. Host and creator, Cheryl Hunter. Executive producers, Colin Whelan and Rebecca Sermons. Head producer, writer, editor, Celine Beth Calderon. And music by Mickey O'Brien.